I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Robert Desmond, inspiration for The Ride for the Living, on his epic 1,350-mile bicycle journey from England to Poland, reenacting the Kinder Transport. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Today we begin the Jewish calendar month of Elul, last month of the year when we begin to prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish Days of Awe, the High Holy Days, exactly 4 weeks from now, beginning with Rosh Hashanah, Sunday night, September 9th. To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of the month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, to apologize to those we've wronged or injured. Blowing shofar is a great way to wake everybody up. Shofar is a ram's horn, hollowed out. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own. At every synagogue I've served as rabbi, we have always done so. And with a bit of practice, you too can learn to blow the shofar. It is a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days, an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. I brought a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us in on this Two Jewish show. Well, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you ought to be by now. To play us in this morning more elegantly on the same theme of the shofar at this commencement of the month of Elul, we begin with a setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tekah b'shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty and gathering our exiles from the four corners of the earth to return. Perhaps even to return to temple for services on Rosh Hashanah.
Lay our sail.
is Tekaba Shofar for the coming High Holy Days in the season of the Shofar, a setting, and a lead cantorial part by my father, Rabbi Baruch Kohan. You know, this time of year is very much a period of return in many ways. Where I live, here in southern Arizona, it's the time when public schools and supplementary schools, you know, Hebrew schools, and universities return for the fall term. Even though temperatures in mid-August in the Sonoran Desert are still rather, warm. It's a time when schedules for all organizations begin to revive, when work of every kind speeds up, and life returns from its summer lassitude to a state of normality, even becomes a little hectic. It's a good time of new beginnings. Although in the Jewish annual cycle, this is actually the end of the old year, not the beginning of the new year just yet, still, it's a healthy thing, this return to engagement with our regular lives after a summer lull. It re-engages us with the parts of our lives that we could allow to lie fallow over the last couple of months, brings us back more actively to our work and our relationships with those in our community. This final month of the Jewish calendar year is a good time, and a special one, to reconnect in so many positive ways. Speaking of connections, our guest this morning, Robert Desmond, is a remarkable young man and well worth connecting to. He was the inspiration for the Ride for the Living in Poland and his book about his own experience seeking out both adventure and Jewish meaning and purpose on a 1,350-mile bicycle journey. Well, it's a great story. Meet him when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome our guest to Jewish this morning. Robert Desmond is a very interesting Jewish guy from England who decided to, for complicated reasons, bicycle from England all the way to Poland, kind of reversing the track of the Kinder transport during the Holocaust. It's a fascinating story. He's written it in a book and has become highly active in the Jewish community in Krakow, Poland. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing well. So tell us how this whole thing evolved. Now it's some 5 years ago?
The slightly longer version is I went to Auschwitz about 8 or 9 years ago, just out of university. It was something that I always felt I should do and was just overwhelmed by what I saw and felt actually standing in the place where all of these atrocities happened. It really hit me quite hard, and I kind of went home with a goal to get friends and family to go. But the problem is people are scared of going. They don't want to go and be depressed standing in Auschwitz, which is completely understandable, obviously. Over several years, I struggled to get people to go, and one of the ideas was, hey, why don't I do a big trip like this, raise some awareness, write about it, blog about every day on the trip, and sort of educate more people this way. It just so happens that I also met the JCC in Krakow, which, as you know, is an amazing place.
Truly amazing, yeah. Absolutely.
And then we decided, we were sort of discussing about ideas, and we sort of realized my bike ride shouldn't end at Auschwitz, but actually there's Jewish life today. So we created Ride for the Living 5 years ago now.
So tell us about your bike ride. Now, you know, somehow these always start out with a relationship, if that's correct.
So I did, I throughout this whole thing, it's quite interesting. The first trip that I actually did with my father, we went to Eastern Europe. We went to trace our family in Kiev, just north of Kiev. And we went with a charity called World Jewish Relief, which is very similar to the Joint in America.
Right, the Joint Distribution Committee, the famous organization, and they work with communities all over the world.
And World Jewish Relief do the same thing, and we sort of went to trace our family and visit some projects over in Kiev. But we thought, hey, if we're going to Eastern Europe, you know, Auschwitz is in Eastern Europe, we should probably go there. out of, I don't know the right term, but Jewish guilt is, I don't know quite what it is, but there's a yearning to go and pay. And we sort of went to trace our family and visit some projects over in Kiev. But we thought, hey, if we're going to Eastern Europe, you know, Auschwitz is in Eastern Europe, we should probably go there out of, I don't know the right term, but Jewish guilt is, I don't know quite what it is, but there's a yearning to go and pay respect and understand and learn more. None of our family, fortunately, were involved in the Holocaust. They all moved over from Kiev, which was Russia, and Lithuania. But we still felt an urge to go. In the year after, we actually followed up some of the projects, and we went back to Lviv in Ukraine, and I happened to meet a Polish lady who was across the square. I said to my friend, oh, she looks very, very nice, and he went up to her and introduced me to her in a very informal way, which was quite funny. And we stayed in contact, and I just knew she was pretty special. And she happened to live 40 kilometers, like 25 miles down the road from Auschwitz. And so this idea of, hey, I should go to Poland to see what happens with this relationship. But actually, I could also tie it in with a bike ride and learn and educate.
We will talk much more with Robert Desmond about that bike ride, kind of an epic one, and how it's led to so many interesting things when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, or downloading or subscribing to them on the iTunes Store, the Apple iTunes Store. We're now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Too Jewish, Deep Wisdom from Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews. No eggs and no cream, just syrup, seltzer, and milk. Zen of the egg cream. And today I am a man. Tomorrow I return to the seventh grade. Those were two koans of Zen Judaism, two haikus for Jews. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So the Weintraub Israel Center is not the only Israel Center in the United States of America, obviously.
True, but there are not too many.
There aren't too many. Yeah. Not that you're not the greatest madrich in American Judaism today. Of course you are. But talk a little bit about the whole concept of having representatives come and spend time, even though you've been in the United States a long time, representing Israel in America and the existence of Israel centers and how unique they are.
Right. So, you know, when I start talking about it, obviously every country that you and I know have representatives in other countries, you know, talk about foreign ministries, obviously, you know,
ambassadors
in the embassy, consulate general.
All right.
Yeah, so obviously, so when you go down the level, you know, you have the Israel centers. So the Israel centers, you know, their main goal is obviously to build a people-to-people bridge between the local residents and Israel. So that's what we do.
So this idea of having, because they're not exactly like consulates, right?
You're not a formal part
of the Israeli government. You don't get visas or extend any of those things.
True.
Talk a little bit about how that idea evolved, because it's a partnership.
Right. So basically, first, it's a project. You know, locally here, it's a project that that was funded 20 years ago, and it was by the Jewish Federation and the JCC. Okay, so I actually served the two, Federation and JCC. And then the Jewish Agency is our partner in Israel. So all we do, as I said before, is connecting Israel to Tucson in different departments, as if it's advocacy, if it's education, if it's bringing the Shinshiniot here, so we'll have authentic relationship, you know, age-wise, and not someone old as I am, but, you know, younger. and bringing teachers and working with school twinning with our partners in Israel, which is Chof Ashkelon and Kiryat Malachi.
I just came back
in the south.
So in doing that, so the idea is to create a connection to Israel,
right,
and to help teach and explain about the country in a positive way.
Right.
How many Israel centers are there in the country, really?
So honestly, I don't know how many, but I can tell you that in the 25 years that I've been here, there were Jewish federations that had, I would say, an Israel department within, not too many. But Israel centers that I personally, again, I'm going to go check and get back to you. But
please do.
Maybe 5-6, not more than that.
So but very
I'm going to
get
back
really,
to you.
Yeah.
Very few, yes. It's
an extraordinary resource. And I will tell you, it's made a tremendous positive impact. Lots more people going to Israel, connecting with Israel, connecting directly with Israelis, understanding Israel. We've had on two Jewish fire representatives,
right,
police
yes.
representatives, you know, emergency right. personnel sharing, all kinds of really great relationships
right.
have developed
right.
Between the two countries. So
right.
it's a very interesting gig you have here, isn't it?
Yeah, look, there's no question that Israel is important, you know, to the Jewish community, to the general community, and specifically, you know, the Jewish Federation and JCC, otherwise I wouldn't invest in such a center. So I'm really lucky. I'm blessed to be here. I'm happy to be here.
And we're blessed to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll talk next week. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you're recently back from one of both of our favorite places, but yours even more so, Thessaloniki in Greece. Salonika, you know, famous Jewish heritage city. You had some fascinating experiences there.
Right. I try to get there virtually every year because there are people I've been very close with there since the 70s when I worked for the World Union of Jewish Students. And somehow, Thessaloniki is one of these Jewish communities in the world that people keep writing off and saying, this is the last generation. After this generation, nobody's going to speak Ladino anymore. Nobody's going to go to shul anymore. But it always somehow renews itself. It's almost magic. One of my close friends there is the chief archivist in the Jewish Community Archives, which are a very rich source of Jewish history, not only locally of the community of Thessaloniki, which was huge before the war.
Before the Holocaust, right?
But also of the whole Jewish community of Greece, and specifically some of the other important communities in the north of Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So Aliki always has stories. It's fascinating to spend an evening with her, give her a little bit of ouzo, whatever. people come from all over the Ladino-speaking diaspora to look for traces of their family in her archives, and she helps them. This is one of her specialties. She speaks 5 or 6 languages fluently, reads another 4 or 5. She has people coming from Israel, from England, from Holland, from France, from all over the U.S. and Canada, and frequently 2 or 3 generations of the same family will come, and they'll learn something about their family's roots. It might be a kid who was born and raised in L.A., and his parents maybe were born and raised in L.A., but his grandparents came from northern Greece at some point. 3 generations will come to the archives, Aliki, but that's rare. Most Greeks are much more concerned with the Turks or the other political party or the European Union than they are with the Jews. The Jewish community is so small.
Right.
But there is a not very well hidden scandal in Thessaloniki, and it's a pretty much an open secret. Even my taxi driver knew it. Where the National University is was the former Jewish cemetery, and they just like basically used all the gravestones as pavement for the campus of a big new university that was built just before the war. So there were still Jews around to protest this, but they were a Jewish cemetery. And they just like basically used all the gravestones as pavement for the campus of a big new university that was built just before the war. So there were still Jews around to protest this, but they weren't strong enough to protest it as vigorously as they once could have, because there was a huge fire in the early 1930s that destroyed a lot of the Jewish community, and a lot of Jews left at that point for Israel. So there were 2 waves of immigration, and the Holocaust was the 2nd wave. Anyway, my experience of Thessaloniki is it just keeps getting more and more Jewish. There's more places where you can get kosher food. There's more tourism from Israel. There's direct flights from Israel on a regular basis now. So it's a place that should be on every Jewish tourist's list and relatively near the top. You eat very well.
I have to say, I had a wonderful Shabbat in Thessaloniki myself, and the synagogue, an active synagogue, has actually the kind of all of the reminders of all the synagogues it's kind of filling in for that were destroyed at the time of the Holocaust. But it is still a very active and vital Jewish community now. And if you want, you know, those special Sephardic brown eggs, I think Thessaloniki right. might have the best in the entire world.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Ben goes to see his doctor. He's not feeling well. After examining him, the doctor takes a few samples from Ben and asks him to come back the following week to learn the results. When Ben returns, the doctor tells him, "Well, I have good news and bad news, Ben. What do you want to hear first?" And Ben replies, "Well, give me the good news first." "Okay," says the doctor. "They're going to name the disease after you." Just what I always wanted. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. All Jews, whether Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or something else, come originally from a religious culture shaped by its process of applying divine law to very human, fallible, earthbound populations. Our heritage is based on the kind of thinking that takes great idealistic proclamations designed to further morality and applies them to mundane daily life with sometimes fascinating results. A core ideal of Judaism is to work to create a society based on justice, which will lead ultimately to peace and goodness, but it is justice that is always the focus. That's embodied in a Torah portion we'll read Saturday called Shoftim, Judges, filled with the concept of justice. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof, we are commanded, pursue true justice. It's a powerful and remarkable ideal. Our societies must strive for absolute fairness, must be just in every way. But justice is more than high ideals. It's applying sacred principles to the mundane reality of daily life, including rules of ritual observance. Judaism makes no distinction between ethical and ritual laws. All are part of creating a society based on justice. The practical result of trying to apply high principles to basic common practices is a very intriguing way of thinking about things. When you're Orthodox and believe yourself bound to follow Jewish law, halacha, the way of living that requires adherence to all the many rules about diet, clothing, prayer, ritual observances, and study, you sometimes find yourself doing things that don't make much sense. But you do them anyway, because they are part and parcel of the elaborate system of Jewish law that you believe will ultimately bring about holiness in this world. Shabbat, the Sabbath, was originated to teach us the need for making a sacred difference in time in our own lives. The Torah forbids melacha on Saturday, work, as broadly understood. Orthodox Jewish law, therefore, forbids work on the day of rest by providing a variety of prohibitions for actions on Shabbat. Lighting a fire, carrying a heavy object more than a few feet, writing, tearing, cooking in an elaborate way or cleaning, building, swimming, and so on. These laws, quite complex in their interactions with daily life, mean that observant Orthodox Jews do not drive on the Sabbath or turn on electric lights or watch TV or perform a variety of other normal daily actions. However, lest the rules become too restrictive and make life impossible to enjoy Shabbat, which is supposed to be the happiest of days, there are all kinds of ways to make it possible to do what's necessary in order for Shabbat to be pleasurable. For example, if you're not supposed to carry anything on Shabbat, how do you bring your tallit, your tallis, or prayer shawl with you to temple on Saturday morning? The answer is to wear it over your shoulders. Then it's no longer an item you're carrying, but a garment you are wearing. Get it? The problem is solved, even if to the non-Orthodox this may seem slightly absurd. That leads to one of my favorite Jewish jokes. It goes like this. Question: is a person permitted to ride in an airplane on the Sabbath? Answer: yes, as long as your seatbelt remains fastened. In this case, it is considered that you are not riding, but you are actually wearing the airplane. Please understand these complex rules are primarily observed by Orthodox and very traditional conservative Jews, but the thinking that went into creating a system that normal human beings can live with, the pragmatic idealism of Jewish law, influences the ways all Jews think. While we Reform Jews don't follow all the strictures of the Sabbath, our Orthodox families and friends do, some of us make it a point not to go to the mall or randomly shop on Shabbat. My family, for example, keeps a kosher home. In fact, every non-Orthodox Jew chooses which practices to maintain and how to do them. And the reasoning, like my own family's choices about Shabbat observance, we go to temple, but we will go out afterwards to a restaurant. We study Torah, but might watch TV in the afternoon. We'll go on a Shabbat morning hike and have a service and Torah reading during the hike, and so on. Well, these choices are also influenced by a kind of Talmudic thinking that adapts ideals to pragmatic situations. Maybe that's why Jews of every denomination are so good at law. Three Jews are currently on the 9-member U.S. Supreme Court. It's all about applying rules to complex situations to make things work out. It's a kind of intellectual flexibility that seeks to keep in mind and heart the highest principles, while making it possible for all of us to function in society without losing our integrity. All Jews, in one way or another, are engaged in a variation of this process when we seek to live ethically and when we decide which rituals we choose to celebrate and observe. What Shoftim insists on is that we seek to apply these ideals to our own lives practically. It's tricky, but tremendously worthwhile, whether or not we think an airplane is really a garment. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Robert Desmond, will explain what led him to cycle from Britain to Poland, how his journey connected him with his Jewish heritage and the dynamic, growing, surprising Jewish community of Krakow, Poland, and will all the consequences of that find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Hamas launched over 70 explosive rockets from the Gaza Strip, and Israel responded by striking military targets in the coastal territory ruled by the Islamist terror group last week. The violence came amid continued attempts by Egypt to broker a broad ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Sirens wailed throughout southern Israel repeatedly last week, warning of incoming rockets from Gaza. More than 20 Israelis were wounded by shrapnel in the border town of Sderot and elsewhere. iPhone video showed Israeli school children screaming as they fled from Palestinian rockets. One Palestinian rocket hit a house, and Israeli media showed footage of houses and cars pockmarked with shrapnel. The military said the Iron Dome defense system intercepted about a dozen of the rockets, and many of the others fell on uninhabited areas. Gaza residents report Israeli airstrikes hit them after the Palestinian rocket barrage. Israel's military confirmed it hit Hamas sites that included an offensive maritime terror tunnel, several terror sites and military compounds throughout the Gaza Strip, rocket manufacturing facilities, and a central logistical military complex. Three Palestinians were slightly injured in those strikes. Shots were also fired from Gaza at civilians working on the barrier that separates Gaza Strip from Israel, damaging a vehicle earlier in the week. Israel said it struck a Hamas post in retaliation. And even earlier in the week, a Hamas terror post in Gaza fired at Israeli troops. Israel struck back, perhaps with tank shells. Hamas said two of its fighters were killed in that exchange. Last week, a UN aid agency called on Israel to allow emergency fuel into the Gaza Strip to avert the shutdown of hospitals and sanitation facilities. Jamie McGoldrick, the United Nations humanitarian coordinator for the Palestinian territories, called Israel's restriction of fuel imports a dangerous practice with grave consequences on the rights of people in Gaza. Israel halted the supply of petroleum and natural gas to Gaza last week in response to incendiary kites and explosive balloons launched from Gaza into southern Israel. Israel also temporarily suspended fuel shipments to Gaza back in July for similar reasons. Israel's been battling large fires caused by these explosive kites and balloons rigged with incendiary devices or burning rags launched from Gaza. They have destroyed forests, burned crops and businesses, and killed wildlife and livestock. The almost daily airborne arson attacks have been part of months of weekly border protests led by the Islamist terror group Hamas. It is aimed in part at drawing attention to the Israeli-Egyptian blockade imposed after Hamas brutally took control of the Gaza Strip in 2007. Oddly, no one seems to focus on the Egyptian side of the blockade, which is actually far more restrictive than the Israeli side. In news not from Israel, Hermann Schein, one of the few people to escape from Auschwitz-Birkenau, became a voice for Holocaust survivors and finally died last week at the age of 95 years old in his California home. Hermann Schein was born in Berlin, named Mendel Scheingesicht. He was taken to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp as a teenager before being sent to one of the three sub-camps included in Auschwitz. At Auschwitz, he met Marianne Schlesinger, a woman who worked at the camp and was allowed to live at home because she was half-Jewish, a Mischling. After an exhaustive escape effort that included going through a fence, traveling 9 miles to hide in a barn, Schein married Schlesinger and immigrated to the U.S. in 1947. He went on to describe his experience of working in concentration camps throughout the war to countless Jewish organizations and media publications, detailing the harrowing experiences shared by millions of Nazi victims. The SS walked around with whips, with sticks, with steel bars, you know. They would beat you for any reason, he said. Schein joined one of his friends during an escape attempt while the two worked together at a construction site near the concentration camp. A laborer who helped them devise the plan picked them up in the middle of the night with civilian clothing and led them to a nearby hideout. Eventually, the two traveled to the Schlesinger's home. Her family found them a safe hiding space with a rich German in a villa. They stayed there until the end of the war. I am alive thanks to not one, but a dozen miracles, Schein said in 2009. Less than 200 people managed to escape from Auschwitz out of the nearly 1.3 million who were deported to the concentration camp. Schein outlived many Holocaust survivors, as well as most of the people who helped him escape Auschwitz. He later celebrated Josef Rona, a man who helped him and his friend devise their escape plan. When he was named one of the righteous among the nations, the righteous Gentiles, in 1991 at Yad Vashem. We want our story to be told to as many people as possible, Schein said back in 1990. Yosef not only risked his life, our lives were worth nothing anyway, but he risked the lives of his entire family and his entire village. Israeli filmmaker Moshe Mizrahi, the only Israeli director of an Academy Award-winning film, died last week in Tel Aviv at the age of 86. Mizrahi directed the 1977 Oscar winner Madame Rosa, filmed in France, starring Simone Signoret. That movie, which won for Best Foreign Language Film on behalf of France, is the story of a former prostitute in Paris who survived Auschwitz. Moshe Mizrahi was nominated for Oscars for two other films he directed in the 70s, I Love You, Rosa, and The House on Shalush Street. The Egypt native immigrated to the Yishuv, Free State Israel, in 1946. He studied film in France in the 1950s. He worked most of his career in France before returning to Israel, where he later taught film studies at Tel Aviv University. In 2001, Mizrahi was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Prize from the Israeli Academy of Film and Television. In lighter news, one of the most unkosher of sandwiches just became kosher, in a way. A brand new vegetarian patty called the Impossible Burger has come stunningly close to imitating a ground beef hamburger. It's received incredible reviews for how much it tastes like a burger, and since it's vegetarian, it can be paired with any kind of cheese to make that iconic American treat. The new veggie burger even bleeds like a juicy burger thanks to heme, a protein that put the heme in hemoglobin. Impossible's version is derived from the roots of soy plants. In May, the Redwood City, California-based Impossible Foods announced the burger, which launched in 2016 and is only available for purchase at restaurants, had been certified kosher. Last week, it received a final seal of approval as the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, certified it as safe to eat after answering questions about the genetically engineered substance used to produce this plant-based heme. The Orthodox Union, largest kosher certified certifying agency in the United States, was thrilled to put its seal of approval on the Impossible Burger, said Rabbi Menachem Ganak, CEO of the organization's kosher division and a past guest of Too Jewish. Approving the burger took only 2 months because many of its ingredients already were certified kosher, said Rabbi Yitzchak Gutterman, who oversaw the process. By all accounts, the Impossible Cheeseburger tastes just like the real thing. But don't expect an inexpensive burger. At most kosher restaurants serving the new pseudo cheeseburger, the least expensive of the Impossible Burgers with cheese goes for $22.95. Rabbi Gutterman, who oversaw the certification making the burger kosher, said he has been flooded with questions about it. It's incredibly popular. Everybody is buying it and eating it. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Robert Desmond, who rode from England all the way to Poland. And in hearing your story earlier in the show, it's part of kind of an expression of Jewish interest, but also, of course, personal interest, and where it has led, which is absolutely fascinating. And I have a personal connection to it, having participated in a part of the bike ride that commemorates a part of that experience. Where we left you, you'd met this Polish young woman and thought she was kind of special and thought, you know, you'd go back to visit her, but decided to do it by cycling. How did that go over with your family exactly?
So I really enjoy cycling. I'm not particularly good at cycling, but I enjoy it. I like getting out and seeing places. I've done quite a few trips across Europe before. So I did London to Barcelona a few years before and just really enjoyed kind of being by myself on the open road, putting yourself in new territories where you don't really know what's going to happen. Although obviously you're still quite safe because you're within Europe, and the worst case, you get out your iPhone and you use Google Translate. So I was looking just in my life in general to do another challenge like that. And then Basha being so close to Auschwitz, I kind of thought to myself, I really want to do something. I want to learn more myself and I want to educate others. And just kind of looking at the map of Europe, there were a few places that I wanted to go, one of which was the Normandy beaches. So I started in London at Westminster, where all of the decisions were made during World War II to do the D-Day landings. Followed the road down to the coast, took the ferry over, and visited all of the beaches, which was incredibly fascinating. I recommend if you ever get a chance to go over there. I don't know if you have.
Yeah, I have been. It's an amazing thing to do. I hadn't really planned on doing it, and it was extraordinary.
It's just incredible the scale of the operation that went on there.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
To think of the bravery to say, you know what, I'm going to completely risk my life and go into Europe to free Europe from this evil. I mean, it's incredibly complex and again, something that is incomprehensible from our lives today, or certainly from my life growing up in nice suburbs of North London, having, you know, good education, great healthcare, all of these things that we take for granted, I take for granted today. It's really kind of affected me and makes me want to understand kind of what's happened in the past. So I saw the D-Day landings. I went to the Palace of Versailles, which is where the Treaty of Versailles after World War I was made, which arguably is what set the ground for Germany to have the economic problems that it did, which caused or caused part of the rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party, which is also incredibly fascinating in itself, and you can do whole PhDs on these sorts of things. Other places of interest were kind of the American Cemetery in Luxembourg, which was very fascinating. Flossenbürg concentration camp, Theresienstadt, which is just north of Prague. I know you went on to Prague, but Theresienstadt is really interesting in itself.
It is.
Because the Red Cross basically went, instead of going to any of the other camps.
Right, it was the show camp, and the Nazis made it look like a holiday camp as they relocated Jews to their own city. They made a movie about it. Eventually executed all the people who made the movie, of course, because they were all Jews. Anyway, Theresienstadt is a powerful place as well.
And if you watch the videos, they're like playing football. I think they're in a swimming pool, which of course...
Right, there's a show. There's all kinds of fake stuff, really.
It's really terrifying that could have happened. I then went on to Nuremberg, where obviously the rallies took place. So I saw that big field where Hitler addressed the whole Nazi army, essentially, or a huge part of it. And then obviously the trials after the war were there, which I went and saw that now museum, but the courtroom, which was incredibly strange to walk into. I don't really get these feelings of spirituality anywhere that I go, but walking into that courtroom, there was like a sense of evil in there that I can't, it's very strange. And then obviously sort of finishing in Auschwitz, where like there is too much to even try to begin to comprehend.
So you completed this extraordinary journey and then wandered unbidden into the JCC of Krakow. At least that's how the story runs.
Pretty much. I on the first trip to Krakow, my father and I, we visited the JCC for a Friday night dinner. And I think the anticipation of going to Auschwitz kind of didn't let me comprehend. Hold on a second. Everyone here, they've stayed in Poland. They've lived under communism. They've hidden their Jewish identity. And now, only 29 years after the fall of communism, or then 20 years after the fall of communism, have they been able to outwardly say, hey, I'm Jewish, and that's been accepted by society in Poland. And to see community members, there's one in particular who unfortunately has passed away now, Mundek, but he would get up on Friday night dinners and start singing Yiddish songs, and not that many other members of the community knew the songs, but he was from Krakow, and he sort of said, these songs have not been sung for 80 years, and now I have a place where I can actually sing them. So much so that everyone in the community learnt those songs after every Friday night dinner, and actually everyone now continues to sing the Yiddish songs, which I think is just beautiful. And so I wandered back to the JCC and was moved to tears, literally, and thought, there's something special here. I want to be a part of this. And at the time, we stayed in Poland. I moved. So the story with the girl is I moved in, and I stayed in Poland for 3 years. We then moved back to London for a couple of years, but I've actually just moved back to Poland because there's like a spiritual calling to sort of come back here. As another aside, we now have a nearly 3-year-old son, Jacob, and we have another baby boy who will be coming in 2 months.
Bisha Tova, we say. May it be all good and wonderful news. So this has been really so central, not only to your experience, but to the development of your life going forward. I want to talk a little bit about the Ride for the Living, which was designed really, you know, here this nutty young Brit just, you know, walked in and said, oh, I did this ride, and I was here before with my dad, and they said, well, how about if we do this, instead of finishing at Auschwitz, starting at Auschwitz and ride to the JCC of Krakow? That's kind of how it came about, right?
Exactly that. I mean, I think I was going to the JCC for maybe 6 months. And I don't know, I was talking about doing more cycling. And then we sort of said, hey, why don't we all do a cycle together? In fact, why don't we do like a fundraiser type thing, raise awareness? And Auschwitz is an important part of the Jewish story. It hugely shaped our people, but it really doesn't define us. You know, the story doesn't end in Auschwitz. It's definitely shaped us. It's definitely shaped this part of the world. But we have not sat down and said, hey, we're victims. We said, hey, okay, this has happened. What do we do now? Let's stand up for ourselves. Let's turn what we have and let's make the most of what life we have now. And that message, I think, is extremely powerful for me and has obviously resonated with people over the years.
When you see how much it's grown, you know, the first year, I think you said there was like 5 or 7 people that did it or something?
Yeah, there were 15 of us.
15, I'm sorry. I undersold you a little bit.
There were a few of my friends from London. There were a few of Justin, who was volunteering at the JCC through the JDC, through the joint. And his family came. The Rabbi Avi, some of his family came in the first year, I think, or maybe it was just Avi. There were 15 of us in the first year, and we thought this is kind of really special. In fact, we hadn't really planned it properly, and we got very lost on the way, and we had to rush in for Shabbat, as I know you did as well.
I did, it's true.
Then the second year was just incredible, because we got a bit of publicity. People thought it was a very nice idea. And we got a call halfway through the year from a guy in Canada. And we're like, wow, okay, we've reached all the way to Canada. That's pretty cool. And then he said, oh, by the way, I'm from Krakow. And we're like, oh, that's interesting. And he says, oh, yeah, and actually I was in Auschwitz when I was a kid. And I'm a keen cyclist, and I want to come back with my family to retrace the exact route he had to walk after he was liberated from Auschwitz to Krakow, where he tried to find his family. And this is, of course, Marcel Zielinski, who you rode with, who is just...
amazing guy. What an phenomenal person.
And what's so interesting about him and a lot of Holocaust survivors is there was a huge period of time where they didn't speak about their experiences, or if they did try and speak about it, people would sort of say, okay, hey, we don't want to talk about that, we know what happened there, let's talk about something else. Whereas now Marcel he's joined March of the Living for the last 4 years as well. He's done the ride as well. He's done talks across loads of schools in America and Canada. So it's really been something quite special for him too. And from the year two, which was 85 people we got to, then it was 120 and then 150 and then 200 this past year.
What an extraordinary experience. And oh, you know, by the way, Greg LeMond, the 3-time Tour de France champion, just happened to ride with us, you know, and was a really nice guy and chatted with everybody and shared stories and helped people and, you know, wow.
He was fantastic. And what amazed me even more was he completely got the point of the trip.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he stood up and Auschwitz, in front of Auschwitz-Birkenau on the opening ceremony, and said that he's just so proud to be part of this, and he's learned so much over his tour of Auschwitz the day before, and that he's honored to be part of this group, sort of riding together kind of as one family, family and friends, which I think was beautiful that he came and he had that such a powerful experience. He suggested that he might come back next year as well. He's pretty keen on it, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see, but you know, it was phenomenal. It's an amazing experience. Robert, you wrote a book about your original experience. Is that available still?
It is. You will have to probably email me or contact me through my website, as it's and there's a big box right beside me.
And your website is, just for our listeners?
It is Dezco, D-E-Z-C-O. I think you guys...
we call it a Z, but yes, D-E-Z-C-O.
.co.uk, .co.uk.
.co.uk. Robert, thanks so much for a great visit. I'm sorry, go ahead.
All of my blog is up there, and that's basically what the book is. It's that blog, those raw personal experiences when I was doing that original bike ride for 25 days. Sort of blurted out of my mind. It's all on that website.
It's a great blog, a very nice website. Thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I hope to see you on the ride next year.
That would be fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Katka Reschke, PhD, author of The Return of the Jew. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Most popular podcasts in America, top 10, according to Moment Magazine. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Itai Levy, and it's called Pitom Ahava. Suddenly, love. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
אז בואי ניקח את זה לאט לאט עד שתרגישי מדגדג שמה בתוך הלב עד שירגיש שאני לא מסוגל עלייך ואולי את תפתרי לי את האולי אולי זו את אז תשאירי לי פתקים על המקרר מילים של אהבה בוערת והכל עובר כמו נשיקה בלחי או שירים שאת שומעת זה ייגמר איתך בבכיות רבה אז בואי וכנסי לי ללב אכפת לי מה תלבשי אין פה סלקציה רציתי רק תדעי ש... העולם יפה יותר כשאת כאן רק תבואי עד שתבואי לוקח אוויר תגידי לי אם אפשר אותך לכל החיים אז בואי ניפול רק בין כוכבים תבקשי משאלה שכולם ירקדו לי ולך ינגנו כל הלילה שירים שירי אהבה ואיך זה שאת ככה יפה לי תביני שזה לא היה לי ככה באת לי פתאום פתאום אהבה וזו שעושה לי פעמיים כי טוב להסתכל עלייך שוב לדבר בלי לחשוב אז תעשי לי פרפרים ככה בתוך הלב חזק 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 עד שירגיש אוהב את העיניים שלך אחרי אלכוהול כאילו כלום אבל למרות הכל ולמרות הכל את יפה יפה שר לך בחלון על סבל פואטי עם הקסם הנכון את מוזמנת אליי פה ללב לא אכפת לי מה תלבשי לא אין פה סלקציה רציתי רק תדעי ש... העולם יפה יותר כשאת כאן רק תבואי ועד שתבואי לוקח אוויר תגידי לי אם אפשר אותך לכל החיים אז בואי ניפול רק בין כוכבים תבקשי משאלה שכולם ירקדו לי ולך ינגנו כל הלילה שירים שירי אהבה ואיך זה שאת ככה יפה לי תביני שזה לא היה לי ככה באת לי פתאום פתאום אהבה ועד שתבואי כבר אין לי אוויר תגידי לי אם אפשר אותך לכל החיים אז בואי ניפול רק בין כוכבים תבקשי משאלה שכולם ירקדו ועד שתבואי כבר אין לי אוויר תגידי לי אם אפשר אותך לכל החיים אז בואי ניפול רק בין כוכבים תבקשי משאלה שכולם ירקדו לי ולך ינגנו כל הלילה שירים שירי אהבה ואיך זה שאת ככה יפה לי
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.